to order, and
yep.
And start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Gasell.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lomer. Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zillis.
Okay. Who wants to approve the minutes for January 11th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative O'Neill moves the minutes for January 11th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Okay, members, we have an overview of the Department of Public Safety today, and Commissioner Doman, would you like to take the table there? And give your name and title and proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. For the record, my name is Mona Doman, and I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. To my right is Deputy Commissioner Cassandra O'Hearn, and you'll hear from her in a bit as we take a little bit deeper dive into the divisions within the Department of Public Safety. But thank you. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to present the overview of our agency this morning, and I appreciate your time. In addition to the Deputy Commissioner being with me, we also have our division directors that lead each of the divisions that we're going to talk about today with you, the divisions that are under your jurisdiction for budgeting. The Department of Public Safety is a state agency with local impact across the entire state. When a disaster strikes or when a crime occurs and local agencies need our assistance, they call on us to respond to their request and assist with state resources where we can. And we do that in many ways. Just give you a quick example. You probably read in the news about the explosion that happened in Dodge Center down in Dodge County yesterday. We had members of our State Fire Marshal's Division and our Minnesota State Patrol assisted around the scene in that as well. And our Office of Pipeline Safety folks headed down too, just to make sure that we had all areas covered in the event that we were needed down there. The storms that hit in 2016 across much of the state, our staff from the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management has been on the ground helping people from day one in the areas that have been hit across the entire state. And I just have to say there are just daily examples of how we work to help keep the people of Minnesota safe. The mission of our agency is to work with our public safety partners across the state to keep Minnesotans safe. We do that through prevention, education, preparation, recovery, and enforcement. Our focus is the same as all of our public safety partners, saving lives and providing efficient, effective, and professional services. We work every day to maintain the public trust and to build upon the strong partnerships that we've developed. So the Department of Public Safety consists of 10 separate divisions, and as you can see on the slide, administration and related services, as you can see on the slide, actually. Administrative and related services down on your lower left-hand side of the slide includes human resources, affirmative action, and internal affairs, and our fiscal section. So there are three pieces to the administration and related services, in addition to the other 10 divisions. As you can see from the slide, and I won't read all of the different divisions, but we have a quite diverse agency and complex. And we'll discuss today the divisions that fall under the jurisdiction of this committee, and they're on the right side of the screen. I'll just go through those and introduce the director that leads each of those divisions. For alcohol and gambling, That is led. That division is led by Carla Sincotta. Carla was just, is the new director, she was just appointed in October after Michelle Tuckner retired then. The Fire Marshal Division, under the direction of State Fire Marshal Bruce West. The Office of Justice Programs, led by Rayon Magnuson. Emergency Communications Networks, led by Jackie Mines. Homeland Security and Emergency Management, led by Director Joe Kelly. And the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, with Superintendent Drew Evans at the helm. So the next slide just shows a bit of history. I won't read it, and I know it's small. I hope that you can see it. But probably, you know, the most significant is in 1905, the position of state fire marshal was created in Minnesota, and in 1969, the Department of Public Safety was created. And here's just a picture of what the troopers were driving to give you sort of a snapshot of what things looked like in 1969. They drove Fury Pursuit sedans. So our base budget at DPS is $730,807,000, and we receive funding from something like 500 different sources, primarily through, though they are broken down between trunk highway funds of $203 million, the general fund, a little over $220 million, state government special revenue of $154 million, a little bit more than that, the highway user tax distribution funds, and miscellaneous special revenue funds. Our expenses then totaling a little over $730 million go towards total compensation for employees, operating costs, local assistance, and transfers. And so before now I turn it over to the Deputy Commissioner for a bit deeper dive into the divisions, I'd just like to thank you again for your time to present our overview. And we look forward to working with all of you as we move through this legislative session and beyond, and we appreciate your support. We'll be available for questions when we're finished. Thank you.
Thank you. State your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Cassandra O'Hearn. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety.
Ma'am, did you used to be in a different position before that, like in the legal?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we crossed paths, Chair, when I was at the Attorney General's office,
there we go.
Representing the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay. Thank
at
you.
At that time. Yep. So the first division that we'll talk about is the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. This is one of our department's smallest divisions, with 18 full-time employees. It's responsible for inspecting, regulating, and enforcing the state's alcohol and gambling laws. So it has two sides, alcohol and gambling. And the alcohol, yes, yeah. Oh, thank you. The alcohol side, the AGED staff work with the industry to provide education, assistance, and conduct oversight investigations. Minnesota has seen a large increase in liquor licenses over the past few years, given the popularity and the rapid growth of the micro distilleries, brew pubs, microbreweries, and farm wineries. Currently, there's over 31,000 liquor licenses. So the gambling side provides technical assistance regarding the state's gambling laws. It investigates complaints of gambling fraud, illegal gambling, and theft or fraud having to do with charitable gambling organizations as well, to ensure that those charities are in fact receiving what they expect to. They work with tribal nations in the state and tribal compacts in order to verify compliance with those compacts. They're funded through an annual appropriation of $1.58 million. They collect money in a special revenue account, of which $500,000 every year is transferred to the general fund. They also provide funding for the Gambling Control Board. State Fire Marshal, if you go to the mission. Mm-hmm. Mission of the State Fire Marshal's Division is to protect lives and property by fostering a fire-safe environment through a variety of different ways that include investigation, enforcement, regulation. They're also responsible for collecting data to provide information on fire deaths and on public education. This slide shows a number of their services, which includes the investigation unit. So that would be assisting and supporting local fire and law enforcement authorities and other agencies with fire and arson investigations, providing training to ensure that other entities are able to perform some of that work as well as conducting and assisting with those fire investigations and fire deaths. They provide a lot of public assistance and materials for public education, and you're probably aware, particularly during various holidays, of the public announcements that they do. For instance, turkey fryers and the dangers around that, candles, Halloween costumes, and, of course, fireworks. The State Fire Marshal Division receives an annual appropriation of $5.75 million from special revenue funds. We move to our Office of Justice Programs, which I think sometimes feels like it provides a different area of for the Department of Public Safety, in that its prime focus is on crime victims. Are we getting feedback? It's going beep, beep, beep.
I'm so hard of hearing, I can't hear it.
Usually
somebody's phone. Yeah, I think you're using it. Oh, it's his phone. If somebody's got a phone on or put it in your pocket or whatever. If sometimes you get them near the microphone and it sounds off. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you. So the Office of Justice Program is responsible for providing leadership and resources for programming and services that assist crime victims in local communities. They have three distinct areas: the Crime Victim Reparations Unit, Crime Victim Justice, and their grants management. The Crime Victim Reparations reimburses individuals and families for losses that are experienced as a result of violent crime. They provide funding for funeral expenses, medical costs, lost wages, things like that. The Crime Victim Justice Unit assists individuals who believe that they have not been treated fairly in some fashion during the criminal justice system. And the Grants Management Unit grants out a lot of money to different areas. The Crime Victim Services grants are focused on serving those crime victims of domestic assault, sexual assault and violence, abused children, other types of things like that. The Justice and Community grants go to also a wide variety of organizations, local units of government, law enforcement, to reduce crime, delinquency, drug abuse, and other focus areas. The Office of Justice Program receives an annual appropriation from the General Fund of $38.6 million. In addition, they administer other state and federal grants to over 750 nonprofit organizations and local units of government. Emergency Communications Network. They fund and support public safety's mission-critical communication solution for emergency personnel and the citizens of Minnesota. They make sure that when someone calls 911, the responders know where that individual is and can respond appropriately, and that all emergency responders then are able to talk to one another. Right. So they have two different focus areas. 911 is funded by collecting a monthly fee that is assessed on all wired, wireless, prepaid wireless, and pocket-based telecommunications. That's VoIP. I had to ask about that. It contracts with telephone companies to provide those 911 services. It also provides the resources and leadership for ARMOR, It's the Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response. This is ensuring that the radio systems that our emergency responders can communicate, regardless of what organization or governmental unit they come from, if they are able to respond, they will be able to talk to one another. Emergency Communication Networks receives an annual appropriation of $77 million from the 911 Emergency Services account of the Special Revenue Fund. HSCM, Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Their primary purpose is to help ensure that communities are prepared to respond to emergencies and have the resilience to quickly recover from the effects. They deal with the four components of the emergency management cycle: preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation and prevention. So on the slide gives some examples around their preparedness work, focusing on rail safety, school safety, and radiological preparedness. The response area, right, is to coordinate a state response for these disasters, whether human or natural disasters, and coordinate the statewide and volunteer resources that are necessary to respond to a particular situation. Recovery. They help communities recover by administering FEMA disaster programs, administering the state disaster public assistance program, and coordinating with local communities to ensure their long-term recovery. And, of course, always better if we can be prepared in advance, mitigation and prevention strategies. They administer federal mitigation programs, and they work towards ensuring critical infrastructure is protected in the state of Minnesota. HSCM receives an annual appropriation from the general fund of $2.3 million. They also are a pass-through agency for federal funds, so they are other unit that grants out a significant amount of money. A special revenue fund assessment from railroads and pipeline companies. They receive a $2.5 million a year that will expire in 2017. They also manage the state disaster contingency account. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the BCA, provides specialized law enforcement services to criminal justice partners all across the state. So you know we have a decentralized criminal justice partners, and so not every law enforcement unit has the resources necessary in order to respond, investigate complex investigations or things along that line. The BCA, it focuses on filling the gap and providing the resources and expertise necessary. They are an assisting agency to assist local criminal justice partners as well as others as well. They're complex investigations, most notably in the news recently. The work on the Jacob Wetterling is an example of a complex investigation, taking over 27 years and utilizing every part and unit within the BCA. Violent crime, narcotics, predatory crimes, right, ensuring that internet crimes against children, we can enforce, get those individuals that are preying on our most vulnerable and get them into the criminal justice system. The forensic science services, most notably their labs, and they have many. They're listed on the screen, but drug chemistry, DNA labs, firearms, fingerprints. They work a lot with blood alcohol testing and toxicology, as well as other crime scene services. Minnesota Justice Information System, great acronym we use, MINJIS. That is the collection of information necessary to conduct criminal history background checks. There are many statutory requirements for individuals working with or vulnerable populations are required to go through criminal history background checks. BCA ensures the accuracy and the complete information so that those that need to provide, make decisions about individuals' fitness to perform certain duties are able to do that. They secure that data to ensure the appropriate dissemination of it. In addition, they gather information so that others can provide information around how best to deploy resources and create programs in communities. If we didn't have the data, we wouldn't be able to know what type of crimes are being committed where, when, and really be able to deploy those resources necessary. The BCA also has a training and auditing service. They provide audits of criminal justice agencies who have access to these databases to ensure that they are maintaining that data, that they are using it appropriately, and that they have appropriate security around that to comply with FBI security measures. In addition, they provide statewide law enforcement training, training that is not available to many law enforcement agencies because they're just too small. So they provide that training to ensure that our peace officers in Minnesota have the highest level of skill development that we can do. The BCA receives a direct appropriation of $56.8 million. Now, this slide's a little complicated because that's what it is in fiscal 16. It's a little less in fiscal 17, $52.9 million. It's split between general funds and trunk highway funds. The difference is because in fiscal 16, there were funds that were dedicated towards the crime reporting system and the criminal history system, and those funds expire. With that, we stand for questions.
Okay, I have several. And the first one, maybe, I don't know if you've got somebody else, director, that wants to answer this, or if you folks can. What the status on the issue of testing the sexual assault kits that's been in the news and been committee before, a status on that and the progress, and what's the status right now today? If somebody asked about it, what would you tell them in the media? Drew Evans, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I am the superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The status of the sexual assault kit testing in the state of Minnesota is currently that we did the survey that the legislature requested to identify the number of kits that were currently in law enforcement agencies across the state. There's about 3,400 kits that are on the shelves in Minnesota law enforcement agencies across the state of Minnesota, and we're currently working with a number of partners. MnCASA's developed a working group in the interim to start talking about these issues and determining which types of kits should be tested, which kits are tested, what is the current status of those kits in Minnesota, and we're working with some of our law enforcement partners who do have kits sitting on their shelves that they'd like to see tested to look at different ways of examining sexual assault kits in the state of Minnesota. But currently those 3,400 kits are there. I will tell you anecdotally, there has been some policy changes within law enforcement agencies because we've seen a significant number of increases in the number of sexual assault kits that have been submitted to the BCA, and so we are testing those kits as they come in based on the policy decisions of those agencies.
Okay, on that point, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to that point. I've actually been attending those working groups probably fairly soon after they started. And so we're putting together some plans moving forward. But, you know, my idea coming forward was that if they could deal with it without legislative authority or without a legislative mandate to do so, it'd probably be better than us having to tell them to do it. But, to put it in perspective, I think, Superintendent, you process about 1,000 per year. And so if we sent them 3,400, can you imagine the backlog? And so then current cases would not get priority or, could be in the mix of all of that. So we want to do things very carefully, very cautiously moving forward. There's also, you know, from the working group, there's potential that things don't need to be tested because the case has been resolved, or we certainly don't want to test those that are anonymous where the victim did not give permission for them to test. And there's still questions as to, in that 3,400, are there some of those in there as well? So there's a lot of unanswered questions in the working group as we've been working through some of those issues. But there are other things that we've been talking about that have come up in a little bit better direction as to which ones should be sent and which ones should not. So there's a lot more questions, actually, than answers that have come through the working group. But I know Mincasa is here as well, so they may want to speak to that as well.
Okay, thank you. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up basically on the chairman's question. So has there been any inroads in getting that 3,400 down? Or we're just still talking about it?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, some of those kits have been tested, so we're working with some of those agencies. We've requested, out of those 3,400, we've been in contact with some of those agencies. It's not a large number. As Representative O'Neill noted, if we took all 3,400 in today, it would cripple our laboratory. But the ones that we examined in that process that we definitely believe should be tested immediately, we made contact with those agencies and asked them to be submitted to the PCA.
Chair, roughly how many is that?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the number is, so we're working with one in particular, Duluth PD, and a couple other agencies. I would say the number is under 100.
Thank you.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question goes to the alcohol piece. And this is a what-if question. If Sunday liquor sales does pass, what effect will that have on the ATF or our alcohol division? Has there been any plans to accommodate for that?
State your name and title and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Cornish. for the faux pas. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carla Sincata, and I am the Director of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. To answer your question, we do not anticipate any impact on our division.
Okay. Did Mincasa here, did they want to make any comments about... I don't see anybody.
Mr. Chair, I think Mincasa had come down and then went back up when we switched topics.
What's that?
I believe Mincasa came down and then went back. I think they do want to testify, Mr. Chair.
Okay. You want to make a few comments about this subject?
Good morning, Chair.
Name and title?
Jean Romaine. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. So I would be available to clarify anything that's already been testified to, but I would also state that we have this working group. The working group was convened with funds available from the Office of Justice Programs, and we are looking at how other states have solved this problem, and we do have some progress going forward. The number of kits that Minnesota has that have been untested is quite a bit smaller than most of the other states we're looking at. And again, we want to make sure that those kits are even available to be tested, that they're not anonymous kits or kits where victims haven't given consent to have those tested.
Okay, any questions from members on Representative Zuros?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for the BCA superintendent. About the backlog.
Director Evans.
Mr. Chair, Superintendent Evans, as we're going through the backlog of roughly 3,400 and we're chipping away at that, what are your barriers for making more progress? Is it a physical space issue? Is it a personnel issue? Is it an hours issue? I guess my main question is if we get you some additional funding for this, can we make quicker progress on it, or is there not enough lab stations and places to put people, whether or not enough hours in the day? What's the main limiter?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, when it comes to this, one of the issues, and Representative O'Neill would know this, is that the various constituencies that are working in this working group do not completely, are not exactly in agreement on the reasons that were submitted for these kits, exactly which ones should be tested. And so that's part of what the working group is working through, is some of those kits, like I said, the 50 or so we reached out, were clearly cases that just should be tested under any parameters. Some of the other ones are more of some of the issues that advocacy groups, law enforcement, the different groups that are looking at this issue don't 100% agree, and that's kind of the purpose of this working group, is to try to come to some consensus as to which types of kits should be tested. Should it be all kits in every single case? Should a certain be left to the discretion of law enforcement? And those are the issues we're looking at. In terms of physical space, there's the physical space to do this. 3,400 kits overnight, there simply is not the personnel to address those with our reactive cases and to make sure that the turnaround time remains acceptable for all the other cases in the state. But that's exactly what this working group is trying to figure out.
Yeah. And I guess, Mr. Chair, that was the superintendent brings up a great point about the working group and trying to get everyone on the same page as far as what kits need to be tested. One of my concerns when we first came forward with the idea of doing a sexual assault kit inventory is, what does that number really tell us? And I think we're seeing that now. I mean, it wasn't that long ago when I worked at the Anoka County Sheriff's Office in their crime lab, and one of the first things I did was an inventory of the sexual assault kits maintained at Anoka County. And there's a lot of kits there, and some where the case revolved not around sexual contact happening or not, but around consent, weren't submitted, rightfully so, because consent wasn't being argued, or pardon me, sexual contact wasn't being argued. It was a matter of consent. And so I think there's that instance, or instance on where you might have a victim that goes to the hospital, a sexual assault kit is created, but then in the waning, the following days, perhaps decides not to pursue the criminal process. That kit doesn't need to be submitted. And so the challenge is when we get a report out that the media glommed onto, it said that there was this huge number of kits that had not been submitted to the BCA for testing. That doesn't tell the complete story. And so I think I commend Representative O'Neill and the work of this working group to identify of those kits which ones actually need to be processed, which ones need to be prioritized and submitted. Now, that being said, when that work is completed and those kits are identified, there will be an influx of work for the BCA, the DNA section of the BCA lab that we as a legislature need to make sure that we fund. So they can do their work.
Representative O'Neill, to this point.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the other side of it also is the storage issue, which we've talked about a lot. And so, you know, there was some federal regulations coming down that we thought maybe pertain to the states as well, but it was saying, you know, like 20 years worth of storage for this material. That's probably not probably best course of action for the state of Minnesota to hold it that long, but those are also conversations that we're having, is the storage issue. So, and it's not just the kit, but it's all of the material that comes with the kit. Maybe it's the bedding and the clothing and all these other things that you have to maintain when you have a case. And so the reason that the working group is taking so long is because there's a lot of different factors to consider, and we don't want to inundate the lab, you know, and maybe we could expand the lab slightly. I don't know the cost of something like that, but certainly the cost of storage is a consideration, and it's not just this kit that's this size. You're talking about maybe several boxes worth of evidence as well. So we have to figure out how long we want to store those things, and maybe the case has already been closed and moved on, and we don't need to test anything. And so what would be the point in testing it if it's already a closed case? So there's a lot of factors to consider, and we have a lot of folks at the table trying to make the best decisions we can.
Representative Constantine, on this topic.
It's not a question. I just want to thank Representative Zerot Wass, his explanation. You should have been the one testifying. I thought it was clearer than anything. Nothing personal, but I thought it was more understandable.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, is it about this subject?
No, it is not.
Okay, Representative Becker-Finn, was it about this subject? Okay, then any other questions about this subject before we move on to the next one? Okay, then we go down the list. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, Superintendent, I'm going to have to come back down to the table. Deals with the lab, but not with the sexual assault kit. Over the past few years, we've had the lab itself has had a huge backlog, and it's been difficult getting information to the prosecutors, especially when a speedy case trial was requested. I'm just wondering if the backlog's getting caught up, and some of the restrictions for some of these smaller communities that use the lab intensively for burglaries and stuff like that are soon going to be able to get some, for burglaries, start being able to do some DNA testing through the BCA lab.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, we do test burglaries at the BCA, and some of this has to do with looking at acceptance policies and understanding them. We've implemented some additional training to our law enforcement partners recently in the St. Cloud area, talking about what our acceptance policies are, how they work, what exactly can be submitted, what cannot be submitted. The legislature has funded a number of positions in our laboratory, most recently in our the past a year of supplemental budget, 8 additional DNA scientists that we're in the process of getting online right now, and they will make a significant contribution to Minnesota in reducing some of those backlogs. Burglaries in particular that you mentioned are something that we actively discuss and debate exactly what the best process is in terms of what we should test and when we should test, knowing what some of those offenders do down the line if they're not caught early in the process. Some of the restrictions that we place, some of it has to do with backlog, but often it actually has to do with our experience in DNA and what we find to be the most probative evidence to make sure that we're giving efficient, timely, effective results to our law enforcement partners so they can clear cases most effectively. But that's a little long way of saying, yes, we are making progress on all the backlogs in all of our divisions, and some of them, you know, the various things that we look at, those go up and down depending on the pressures in our communities across the state at any given time.
Reverend Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Superintendent, I want to thank you for that explanation, and I also want to thank you for, I believe in the next week or so, you're going up to my community to talk to my sheriff and my county commissioners about the issue.
Yes.
Okay, three more on the list, Representative Hillstrom and Representative Becker-Finn and Representative Dean. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 18, one of our pages, I guess, on the slide about the direct appropriations that has been received by the BCA, the Dunkel Farm, it said that there was $56.8 million in 16 and $52.9 million in 17, and the money in 16 was for a specific project. Is it complete? Was there enough money? And when you go back down to the 50.5 million, is that adequate for what you need, or will you be coming and asking for more money, do you think?
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the project they're referring to is our criminal history and crime reporting system, two projects interrelated in many respects. We're in the process. It is not complete. The crime reporting system is largely complete, the first phase of that for Minnesota, which will allow us to transition to a from a uniform crime reporting summary data collection, which records only the highest level offense in Minnesota, to a national incident-based reporting system, which will give us a much more complete picture of crime in our communities, because all crimes committed will be reported through the BCA, to the FBI, and it's a more comprehensive way of reporting crime. The FBI has asked everybody to be compliant with that system or transition to that system by 2021. We have gone through our first phase of being NIBRS compliant at the BCA, and then we will be working with vendors that collect that sort of information from our law enforcement across the state, and so we'll go online with that type of reporting. So that system's moving along very well. Our criminal history system, the new system for the state of Minnesota, is on track, generally speaking, within a few months of where we wanted it to be. That's time for the first rollout, and we, like any IT project, we've had our struggles along the way, but we've identified, and we do not, we're not asking the legislature for any additional funding to complete that project, and so we will we're moving along. We anticipate the first rollout of that to be in the first quarter of 2018.
Okay, Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, my question has to do with domestic violence, and specifically the presence of a gun in a domestic violence relationship greatly increases the chances that it will end up in a domestic homicide. And so my question is about the statute change several years ago that allowed judges to order those who are under an order for protection turn in their firearms. And I'm wondering if you have any information about how many guns have actually been turned in as a result of that change.
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I do not have that information. I'm not sure that's information that the BCA actually collects. Related to that, if the judge, I think that'd be information that would probably have to come from the courts, but I could follow up to make sure.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. And Representative Dean.
So I have a couple questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you. One is for, I'm guessing, Ms. Sunkata, about the impact that microbreweries, wineries, all of those new craft products that we have, is that beginning to cause some issues around staffing? And if not, do you foresee in the near future that it may?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we have seen a large amount of growth in the industry, as indicated. Currently, we have three non-sworn investigators who oversee the entire state of approximately 31,000 licenses.
Representative Dean?
That was just trying to check in on that. But I have another question, too.
Go ahead, Representative Dean.
This is for OJP services, and
it relates to the Crime Victim Services Grants. My question is, I know that there's assistance for general crimes, but quite frankly, that only occurs at the time of a prosecution or conviction of the crime, that there would be victim services grants for family members or other individuals. And the reason that I bring this up is I know that occasionally there are hardships on families when an officer may kill a member of the family, and because of 609.066, oftentimes there's no prosecution around that. Has there been any discussion internally with OJP, or is that something that we would have to do here at the legislature to possibly extend some service grants for those family members that are going to be have to taking time off work and all those other types of things to deal with the implications of a loved one that may have been killed?
Ma'am, go ahead.
My name is Raymond Magnuson. I'm the director of the Office of Justice Programs. Mr. Chair and Representative, you are correct in all the information that you have. We've had some internal discussion. Most of the changes you're talking about would need to be done legislatively. We are doing a few changes in the next 2 years through rules, but it does not include that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about some of the sex trafficking things, so I guess we need the BCA back, if we could. It seems to be something not only in my community but also in the news that there's been large sex trafficking rings that have been apprehended and trafficked. So, folks or women and children have been trafficked all across the United States. And I just hope you could kind of tell us your role. And I know the FBI was involved, local law enforcement was involved. And if you could tell us kind of what your role has been to combat that here in Minnesota. Even in my own community, I have a couple massage parlors that are fronts for sex trafficking and they've popped up all over Greater Minnesota, as you know. So I'm wondering if you could kind of shed some light on that. That seems to be a new hot issue.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we look at this even a little bit more holistically at the BCA than just sex trafficking. We look at it as the exploitation of children and vulnerable populations in sex trafficking, et cetera. We focus on things like online exploitation of our children through child pornography, looking at things like soliciting children online and in these human trafficking rings. The legislature provided funding for us to identify human trafficking as one of those three components for us: human trafficking, internet crimes against children or online exploitation, and then our predatory offender registrants in the state of Minnesota. That's our role in working with local jurisdictions who are working with this work that get overwhelmed very quickly because these cases tend to be large, multi-jurisdictional in nature, and we are working to be the kind of in-between that we do for many other investigations to work on those complex investigations with our local investigators across the state and then be the conduit between them and our federal government. We've also had a number of grants through additional increased funding that has been provided through OJP that have been provided to local communities across the state. We actually just met just this week with the grantees, with the BCA and those grantees, to start working on ways to focus our efforts to make sure that we're interconnected along the way, to share information, to identify these sex trafficking rings, and really go to rescue victims of human trafficking across the state and identify the traffickers themselves and to kind of chop off the conspiracies at the head to eliminate them while rescuing those victims. And so we currently have, as the BCA's role, 17 agents that are dedicated to those three activities across the state, and they're embedded in different communities working. They're not centrally located. They're located all over the state of Minnesota to work with communities like yours and all of the representatives here as well.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Superintendent. And can you speak to just what happens to the victims once they are rescued? Where do they go?
Directly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a safe harbor program in the state of Minnesota. There's coordinators throughout the state that identify resources for these victims of human trafficking. And so they provide resources to them across the state. And there's a program under the safe harbor program. There's a administrator at the Minnesota Department of Health that works with those coordinators across the state, and we have a working relationship with them as well. I'm sitting on a committee with the Minnesota Department of Health to examine the very issues you're talking about, to look at this holistically from an enforcement, the resources that we need for the victims once they're rescued, and look at this from a state perspective. What can we do to support our local communities and the providers that are doing this across the state?
I have one final follow-up.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm asked quite often, as these massage parlors have moved into my district, what can a citizen do to kind of combat some of this activity in their own communities?
Director?
That's a challenging question. I think one of the things that is most important to look at is, and what we try to look at are those that are most vulnerable. In other words, are we seeing children? Are we seeing things that are happening that are not simply, legitimate massage locations that are going, that certain types of traffic that are occurring? We're seeing people come in from different communities, trafficked into the community. We see children that are with people that shouldn't be with. And one of the things that we've talked a lot about is really working to share that information across the state, because we're learning that we see some of these traffickers popping up in different locations around the state of Minnesota, and we don't have a great way of connecting the dots. And so that's one of the things we're working on right now, is to try to figure that out as a citizen to report that. We have a webpage that will go live at the BCA soon on human trafficking information with resources exactly on your point for how to identify trafficking there, that they can go to national resources that identify some of the keys to look for as well.
Thank you, Superintendent.
Okay, Representative Pinto has probably got something to talk about the bill we worked on before on sex trafficking and OJP grants.
Indeed, Mr. Chair. Until recently, I was the director of statewide training and protocol development for the Safe Harbor System, so I had a chance to work with the director. And yeah, the grant that he referenced is one that the chair had great leadership. And this last term, so folks are aware that this is the first ever state funding to support local investigations of trafficking cases, and it's gone through OJP, and we did great work. And then in the most than last year, the amount was increased, and so I had a great chance to work with the director and with the BCA and training, the training component and others. And so related to that, Director, I want to ask, in my experience doing this work around the state, you talked about having a broad view of exploitation, and that's true, but I have found that the Internet Crimes Against Children law enforcement officers, officers who focus on ICAT cases, and officers who focus on sex trafficking, and officers who focus on sexual assaults of children potentially, tend to work, and we've talked about this I know a number of times, tend to work very much in separate silos, and kind of to a pretty amazing degree in my experience how separate that is. And so those officers focused on Internet crimes against kids are really not so much working with officers in other areas in the sex trafficking and sexual assault, just and not because of any limitations in, for those particular officers, but just because of how the system is sprung up. So I guess I want to know, I know, Director, that in putting those two components with predatory offender registration, part of the goal is to make that integration, moving towards more integration on that. Can you talk about how that has been going?
I actually might have mislabeled you. You're the superintendent?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm my superintendent. My apologies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, that process for us has been going well, and I think your point is well taken that people were operating in silos, but our agents have found that they've started conducting additional operations that really cross over both of those. There's undercover chats that go on for people that are soliciting children online, trying to meet up with juveniles that are being purported to be trafficked, and so we're identifying the perpetrators along the way and then creating a much more complete picture. In addition, the leadership, the commander for the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force for the state of Minnesota, the commander has been talking about some of these very issues and focusing at a more broad brush to look at this as a holistic view of exploitation, sexual exploitation of our youth and people in this state. And so we're, and as you mentioned, your grants as well, these agencies, many of the people that have applied, they're doing the same types of work. And so we're working to continue to integrate. We'll be continuing to talk about it more, the good work that you did with the training programs in Minnesota. The BCA worked with the Department of Health to apply for that grant, and we'll continue that training to train our law enforcement officers across the state to do exactly what you're talking about in further integration.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Mm-hmm. It feels like a lot of the way the structure follows funding, right? And so it's good that the grants, there's been that integration. I feel like the impression I've had is that part of what's going on is there are the federal grants for ICAC, but they're very focused on that particular piece, somewhat to the exclusion of others. Do you have thoughts about strategies? So that's great, that's happening at state level. We've got these grants that it's a good amount of money, but it's, you know, limited, of course, to what we can do, whether working with federal partners or others, to have a more integrated system so you don't have these local officers who really are, and in my experience, that's continued to be the case, getting better, but to move away from those silos, even at a local level, in terms of how we can work that structurally.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think we need to continue doing some of the things we're doing, and that means that we have these meetings that we've just recently had with all of the grantees to talk about these very issues with members of my agency. We bring in the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, that work on both of those types of activities right now, human trafficking and Internet crimes against children, and to continue to talk about ways. I will tell you, as you noted, the silos still exist in some respects, but ICAC itself is a national program. I have seen slowly start to move to look at this as a broader issue than simply child pornography, recognizing all of this is interconnected in many different ways. And what we're trying to obviously do with this is drive down the demand from the perpetrators to begin with, and we need to look at this holistically if we're ever going to be effective in doing that.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, thank you. I've got a couple of questions on different areas. So, thank you, Director or Superintendent. A couple of years ago, we went over the reciprocity issue for handgun permits, permit to carry in other states. Have you got anybody here that specializes in that, or can you handle that?
If I may, Mr. Chair, I might be able to handle that.
Okay. We had a bill that changed the definition from substantially similar to similar, something like that, and then we wanted to reevaluate the states to see who And I think we ended up, and I might be wrong in some of these figures, but we gained 8, but we lost 4, so a net gain of 4 states that we could probably have reciprocity with. And so now it's come up in the media that we've lost some more, and not so much as the mechanics of why, but who are the people, when you do an evaluation, who are the people by name and title that sit in on the evaluation, and then who is the final deciding person that says, no, Missouri does no longer meet the definition of similar to our law? Who's the team and who's the final decider before that gets put into the directive that...
Mr. Chair and members, my general counsel, Joe Newton, is the one who reviews the request when it comes in from other states. He also works with Judy Strobel, who is an attorney at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and they evaluate the request and then ultimately bring it to me for a final decision.
Okay. And I just wanted to bring that up just for my own information, rather than sit here and talk about what similar and what isn't, and range component and education and that. It's just a question that for the future. So Joe is the fellow that we dealt with before at the testimony table, I think. Isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Follow up to that.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't one of the issues that we've had is that one of the states or a number of the states that used to be similar actually opened the door for other states as well, and so when someone had reciprocity with one state, it also opened a bunch of other states for them to carry in. I believe that I heard something like that from Mr. Olson.
Yes, I believe actually, I'll let you answer that, but there was all sorts of issues. There was the age issue, there was the range issue, there was the classroom issue, the military issue. There was a number of issues that made it either similar or not similar, but go ahead and answer that.
You go ahead and answer.
She outranks me. If I may, Mr. Chair and Representative, the basic sort of way that the department looks at the reciprocity issue is to ensure that individuals from other states are not allowed to carry in Minnesota if a Minnesota resident could not carry. And so as the chair mentioned, there's a variety of different things that look into it, but the base principle is our laws in Minnesota, right, and the parameters of that, and really why should residents of other states get a privilege that is not available to Minnesota residents.
Okay. Any other questions?
Sure.
Representative Dean.
This is a little bit peripheral to your question, and it relates to, I'm guessing, the BCA or DPS. Do you all keep track of guns that are apprehended in criminal activity where the state in which that purchase may have originated? Or do we not have any way of even knowing where how that happens? We have no way of knowing. Because my understanding that, you know, we often talk about what happens in Illinois and Chicago and with a lot of the activity and a lot of people that have been killed, and I think their evidence has shown that almost all of those guns are actually purchased in Indiana, which has very, very open purchase laws for guns. So I just, you know, maybe it's something that is protected under the Second Amendment at this time, but I think it's something we all need to be cognizant of. Thank you.
Sounds like my buddy, President-elect Trump, is going to take care of the reciprocity issue with the federal permit. But Representative Lucero, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two questions, and the second question will be for the BCA. But first question is, in context of the emergency communication networks portion of the presentation, I'm just curious, does the agency have any purview over the emergency broadcast system, or is that outside of your agency altogether?
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Representative Lucero, that is outside of the purview of ECN.
That's what I thought. And Mr. Chair, the second question is for
Representative Lucero.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. So this past December, I saw a very interesting article. It came out on December 29th, and it was in the, from Arkansas. It was a death investigation, and it was having comments about smart speakers and computerized sound systems, such as Amazon Echo, Google Home, and Microsoft, I think, has a competing product. And I recall 2 years ago, we had a tour at the BCA. It was a great tour. And in that budget year, there was an increase. I think there was one or two staff that increased in the computer forensics unit. And my question is, in the last 2 years, as technology continues to advance and there are devices in the smart home and in the cloud, and more stuff becomes internet capable, have you seen an uptick, or how have those resources that were added a couple years back been in relation to potential additional workload?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so there were a number of resources added, actually six additional examiners that we have added or that we're working on at the BCA right now. Part of that process that we've gone through, because the digital evidence examination has become so complex, and as you know, there's smart speakers, there's everything that we look at along the way, we made a conscious decision to pursue ASCLAD accreditation for that unit within our organization. And so we're doing that right now. We're under that process. In the next year or so, we hope to achieve that accreditation, which is the same accreditation we have for our forensic laboratory at the BCA. The average digital evidence that we examine right now is about 3 terabytes per case, which is a large amount of data that we examine. However, in some respects, as you note, things like you mentioned, I think Alexa from Amazon is the one in the one that you note there. A lot of that data is stored in the cloud, and that means that that data can be retrieved via a search warrant by giving a search warrant to the company after a judge approves us getting that, and the company themselves do that data. So The short answer is we see a lot more data in the cases where we get it, but we also have a lot of the data that would have been stored locally at a home is now stored in the cloud, and the company itself will retrieve that data and send it to us. So those resources, have we're in the process of ramping them up right now. We had to develop a training program, and they will make a big dent in our backlog for digital evidence.
Okay. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this might be a question for the Commissioner overall. Actually, I had two that I wanted to touch on briefly. Number one, there's been this emergence of drones. Has that been a factor? Has that had an impact as far as the use of drones in criminal activity, number one? And number two, does your agency utilize drones, and if they do, to what extent?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not currently use drones in our operations. We are having ongoing conversation about how we would apply the use, whether it be in the BCA or the Minnesota State Patrol or any other area, quite frankly, that we do investigations in the State Fire Marshal's Office, Office of Pipeline Safety. So we don't use them currently, but we are having conversations about that. As far as the impact, if we see in crimes involving drones, you really haven't seen, and I haven't really seen much of that across the state either.
Okay. Mr. Dorman, ask you a question. Is Chief Langer in today?
He is not at this hearing.
Oh, okay. Then I'll ask you. The State Patrol isn't really in our jurisdiction here, but more as an overall theme, I've been hearing from chiefs and sheriffs that we're really hurting on recruiting of officers. It's really down the pool to hire from. And then all the testing and the psychological exams washes out even more, and they're really worried about getting the quality officer that they want. How is the State Patrol doing in recruiting right now for officers? And if it is low, what's your plan to get it better or more of a pool?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn to address this. She actually has worked with the State Patrol quite extensively in their recruitment efforts.
Ma'am, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the entire pool is down. So I don't have the specific number, but when the State Patrol posts for their position and they hire in a large group, to do that. In the last hiring process, they saw a dramatic decrease in number of individuals seeking to become state troopers. That being said, they have 49 cadets that will start at their academy starting on this Sunday to do it. So with efforts for recruitment, they have a designated staff individual who coordinates the recruitment activity. They rely on individuals in every one of the State Patrol districts to help coordinate and get that message out, not only about law enforcement as a career in general, but then, of course, specifically the State Patrol in particular, as well as media campaigns, particularly around when they have positions that are opening. They're working with colleges and universities to, again, promote law enforcement as a profession. And I believe you're aware of the program that they have called the Law Enforcement Training Opportunity, or LETO. And that is a program that is designed for any individual with a college degree. It doesn't matter. It can be art history or any college degree. The State Patrol has partnered with Minnesota colleges and universities, MNSCU, to provide the educational requirements necessary to meet post-eligibility requirements. And so out of the 49, I don't have the exact number, believe it was around 13, I think have they started their training back in the fall to go and conduct all of the classroom requirements and take the post test. Upon completion of that, they will be starting the academy on Sunday as well. And from that point on, they are peace officer eligible. So that is one of the hallmarks of the State Patrol as a way to get second career individuals or individuals who did not think about law enforcement as a career at some point because of our education requirements.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, do you kind of a personal question, but do you also then use veterans' preference in your hiring practices with the State Patrol?
State Patrol, Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, the State Patrol does consider veterans. That is a large pool of individuals who are interested in particularly law enforcement of an organization like the State Patrol with that chain of command and strong, you know, paramilitary presence. Yes.
Okay, are there any more questions from the group here? By the way, I had a personal report that your chief's doing a good job, so, you know, the patrol.
Thank you for saying that. I'll share that with him.
Thank you. Anybody, you got any questions? Is this our last group, our only group? If not, thank you very much for appearing, unless you got something you'd like to add.
We don't. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chair.
We'll probably have you come back and do a real in-depth budget review, I imagine, at some point here. So.
And I would just offer, Mr. Chair, too, if anybody wants a tour of the BCA, I think we did that last year with a group from this committee or any other areas. Mm-hmm. If you want to come to see us where we work, we'll be more than willing to set that up for anybody that would like to do that.
That sounds
you could even see the gun room if you would like to.
Since you have so many cops on this board, now you're going to have to furnish a lot of donuts.
Right? Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any members have any questions? If not, meeting adjourned.